Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, Smug Seasoning.
Okay, let's do some words.
Yes. Sounds good. Yeah. I like words.
You go first and I'll eat some more buckwheat.
Okay. What is it good for?
Absolutely.
I tell you,
nothing.
If I cut out that conversation, this bit's not going to make any sense to anybody. So speaking of food that might need some seasoning, that's my word. Is seasoning. And then I'm going to stick around to the other roots as we're branch off to the other roots and uses as well. But seasoning is where I'm starting. Dictionary.com. Oh, side note, if anyone out there is not following dictionaries on Twitter, dictionary Twitter and library Twitter, I mean, you're listening to our show, so I'm assuming that this is a safe recommendation to me, but dictionary Twitter and library Twitter are awesome. Just putting that out there. Follow more dictionaries and libraries on Twitter is the end result.
And oh, much the same way as dictionaries and librarians are awesome.
Well, exactly, yeah. Before we get into that, I almost forgot, and that's cruel and unusual and terrible of me. We have Patreon sponsors to say thank you to.
Thanks. Hey.
So we have Steve Engledow, and we went over this back and forth on Patreon and Messenger a couple times, so I'm really hoping I got that right. But he was one, and then more recently last week, someone named Harun, H-A-R-U-N, I dropped a line and said, can you make sure I'm pronouncing that right? And I didn't hear back. So
like
I'm
Harun
hoping.
And the Sea of Stories, which is a novel by Salman Rushdie.
Yes. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, that's what you were going to say.
Harun and Steve, thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much. We seriously appreciate it.
And it's, it's fantastic. Listening is enough support and is also deeply appreciated, but being able to pay for the bells and whistles is extremely handy and earth-shatteringly awesome. So thank you. And
thank
to
you,
all
thank
our
you,
other
thank
Patreon
you.
Sponsors, thank you as well. Now that's out of the way. Thank you very much. Back to seasoning. So seasoningdictionary.com. Salt or an herb, spice, or the like for heightening or improving the flavor of food.
May I stop you just for a moment?
Sure.
I wish to draw your attention to the great Eddie Izzard. Don't know how aware of Eddie Izzard you are.
I love Eddie Izzard.
Okay. Language, little differences. You know, you say potato and I say potato.
Oh, the herb thing?
I say herb, you say herb. No, you say herb and I say,
herb.
Because it's got a fucking H in it.
Yeah.
So I don't get the chance to hear that one in the wild very often. So when you said herb, I couldn't pass it up.
You got to jump on that. You absolutely do. See, to me, herb is the name of a slight... No, I'm not even going to say it. It's a man's name, usually an older man, almost certainly an older white man.
Okay.
And someone to whom you would stereotypically apply the name Herbert, but who has shortened it in an effort to be cool. That said, I don't actually know any herbs, and that's probably why I have a very general and unflattering association. So salt or herb or a herb. Spice of the like for heightening or improving the flavor of food. Number two, the process by which a person becomes conditioned or, quote, seasoned. So those are seasoning as defined by dictionary.com. Most of the sort of etymological heavy lifting in this word was done pre-English in French and Latin because it sort of arrived fully formed in English in sort of the 1300s, early 1300s. The word season already had the twin meanings, and this is what got me thinking. It's one of these words that I think about because it has two very different meanings, and I'm always kind of get curious and piqued as far as how those two things connect. So for season, it even in the 1300s, it had the dual meaning of a time of year, like a chunk out of a year that is uniformly and discreetly defined by a certain set of characteristics. And it also had the verb sense of improving flavor with spices, etc. So that's always been around as far as it's been in English language. So the transitions happened in French and Latin before that. Saison is the French word for season. And the verb form in French was assaisonner.
Okay.
So with the A on the front of that. But those are the two meanings, how the two things, and then they kind of got blended together when it transitioned into English, I guess, and just became season was for both. Before French, it was from Latin, sationem, which is a sowing or planting. And it's a noun of action from sorere, to sow, and ultimately comes from the Pi root, just S-E meaning to sow seeds.
Right.
And so the Latin seems to have broadened from the act of sowing to the time that sowing was traditionally done. And so it seems like it all signs point to season being originally just another word for springtime. So okay. The season was spring. It wasn't a
spring is the best season after all.
Oh, spring is my least favorite season.
Really?
We can have this. Yeah, everything's because I come from a land where there's it's immediately preceded by 6 feet of snow that then melt and make everything muddy and gross. And everything that accumulated over the course of your previous 13 months of winter is now visible and garbage. It's just, it's gross. And yeah, I hate spring. I like that winter ends and I realize there has to be a transition point between winter and summer. So I begrudgingly acknowledge its necessity, but it's absolutely my least favorite season.
Oh no, I love spring.
In the same way that engagement is my least favorite relationship phase. Was my least favorite relationship phase. Because it's not really a phase it's in itself. Neither. It's just a transition. Yeah. It's just a transitory thing. You're not here. You're not this. You're not that. You're not. Anyway, useless. I recognize its necessity, but I don't like it.
I do not see spring as a transitory phase. But I very much appreciate your point that when the 6 feet of snow melts, things aren't good.
Oh, everything's gross. It's terrible. So the season was spring. And then old sort of Provençal and old French, it was extended to mean they went beyond just the spring and they got the sense that it has now more, they're just sort of a time of year, but not necessarily the four seasons we know in North America or Britain or wherever in the other parts of the world that have four seasons. It's just any kind of specific time of year. So you think of where orange season, lemon season, mm-hmm. lime season,
yeah,
like
sure.
the time yeah. that a specific plant flourishes or bears fruit or whatever else, which is also kind of interesting because it went from the time where you sow to the time when you reap could also be a season.
Okay, that makes sense.
As long as it's a specific thing. So going back to that French word, the French verb form assaisonner, which has the A in front, which is sort of comes from the Latin H prefix ad, sort of meaning to.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it sort of means is bring to season. And so the idea is that since food tastes better ripe than not yet ripe in general, the idea is that you are kind of artificially ripening it. You're artificially making it so that it was as if it had been picked in season when maybe it hadn't been.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Am I?
Yeah, I think so.
Making sense with that. So the idea is you're sort of, you're bringing it as though it were in season or as though it was closer to in season. So it's the connection goes from the time of year to the thing we do for food, because you could either season. The metaphor, the analogy falls apart here, but the idea of you pick an orange 2 weeks before it's actually ripe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to taste as good, but if there was a way to artificially make that food, make it taste like it was a ripe orange, that would be sort of artificially bringing it to season and therefore seasoning it.
Right.
Now, it wasn't until centuries later. So remember, this came into English with these two forms already. So in the 1300s, it already meant the time of year and improving flavor. And it wasn't until 1643 that the OED has the first attestation of of persons or animals fortified by habit, acclimatized, familiarized with a certain mode of life or occupation. So it didn't transition to people or things until way later, which I find sort of interesting. And it, I found that slightly surprising that there was such a huge gap. Because normally these things get applied fairly, in a metaphorical sense, fairly quickly. It doesn't take super long. Now, and again, the ever-present caveat that maybe we don't make explicit often enough is that we always acknowledge that the OED use is not the first use of the word.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
It's the first written use, and because writing was very specialized and it was very classified and it was very sort of ivory tower-esque, things would have been used for centuries before they were, or could have been used for centuries before they were actually written down. So maybe it was something that was used as all the time as slang and didn't get actually written down until 1643. Who knows? I just thought it was surprising because usually it gets written down sooner than that. One of the things that got me thinking about this, and this is, things are getting bleak for a moment.
It always happens.
Anyway, yeah. So the Seeing White series by Scene On Radio and John Bewin, who we had the pleasure of listening to at last year's Sound Education Conference, was like just literally earth shattering for me.
I've downloaded it. I haven't listened to it yet, but it's on my list.
It was so.
Ryan has been telling me how important it is that I listen to this podcast for a couple of weeks now.
Not just Amy, especially Amy, because we saw him at Sound Education. But literally all white people need to listen to this series because maybe I am specific and accomplished in my ignorance, and that's why it was so eye opening for me. But anyway, it was. One of the things that they pointed out is that seasoning was the incredibly euphemistic term for the process by which, when slaves were brought over from Africa, they were literally just beaten into submission. But that was called seasoning them.
Oh, that's horrendous.
When they were, and of course, resulted in many, many, many.
If they're
deaths,
talking about animals, they talk about breaking in a horse.
Yes. Oh. Same idea, but with people in the transatlantic slave trade, it was called seasoning, which is horrendous. But that was one of the things that kind of went, yeah, that's a weird word, and why does that do this, and why does that do that, and why does that do this? Terrible people are terrible. White people have historically been more terrible than others, I think, and everyone should listen to Seeing White, the series. That said, that Proto-Indo-European root, S-E, meaning to sow, has given us some other words, which I think are always fun to look at how these other things connect. So remember, all these words are related to season through this common ancestor of Proto-Indo-European, this good slice of pie.
Good old pie.
To disseminate, as in to sow ideas around.
Okay.
A seminal work is a work that is fertile.
Semen,
I was getting to that, but yes.
Oh, sorry, I've stolen your semen thunder. I'll chalk that up as number 2,804,000 phrases I never thought I'd say.
Yeah, I'd say that should go on a shirt, but that's a niche fashion market. I mean, someone out there, it's the internet, someone out there would wear it, but I don't know who that someone would be. So a seminal work is like a work that is fertile ground for further thought or ideas or works.
Yeah, yeah.
Seminary. A place where priests are trained, a seminary was originally a garden, basically, a plot of land set aside for plants to grow.
Oh.
And then later on it was metaphorically attached to a school for priests and theologians. Seminar.
Where young minds could grow.
Yeah, a seminar, same idea, actually from seminary, so you take seminars and lectures and stuff like that, and it was from that. And yes, it all relates back to semen. So yeah, that's how season comes to mean putting stuff on food and also the times of year that we argue about which is better or worse.
I like it. I find myself, I'm compelled to share this factoid, which is It's such a well-known factoid that it's hardly worth pointing it out, but, you know, I have to. If you do want your oranges to seem as though they're ripe when they're not ripe, store them in a paper bag with some bananas. Bananas ripen other fruit.
Yes, they release a thing that makes other...
Yeah.
Yeah, other things do things. I'm a scientist.
So, yeah, ethylene gas ripens fruit, and it's used in the fruit industry. You know, they'll store fruit that they've picked because it was convenient to pick it in warehouses, pump the warehouses full of ethylene, and ripen the fruit artificially like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's how you season fruit.
Technically, ethylene is a seasoning, yeah. I suppose, you know, when you talk about seasoning, I immediately think about salt. For some reason, in a recipe, the verb is always to season with salt and pepper.
Yeah.
In a way that you wouldn't say season with turmeric or season with coriander. And I suppose you could technically use that verb for either of those substances or for any other strong tasting, you know, flavour influencing substance. But season with salt and pepper, those are the seasonings that we tend to think about. I've just had an interesting conversation with my young tutee, who is half Swedish, half English, about salt and vinegar as a flavour combination.
Oh, okay.
And salt and vinegar is as British as cups of tea. But in contrast to cups of tea, I like salt and vinegar a great deal. And right. I was asking my young tutee if salt and vinegar crisps are available in Sweden. And she said, no, that's not a flavour of crisps that really exists there. And I was very surprised to find that in sort of mainland continental Europe, salt and vinegar crisps don't exist. It's not really a flavour combination that's as mainstream as it is in the UK. How is it in North America?
It's pretty common.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of. I'm trying to think of where there was a place I went where vinegar was. They were shocked that we put vinegar on food because vinegar was just a cleaning agent.
Vinegar's good for all sorts of things.
Oh, it's fantastically multi-use. But yeah, vinegar is...
most delicious on chips.
Yeah. Salt and vinegar, I mean, you'll have vinegar offered at like chip trucks.
Yeah.
And, you know, places that serve fries and such. But it's most common. It's most common as a chip flavor, a crisp flavor.
Okay. Yeah, cool. It's good to know.
But it's definitely on the other hand,
mainland Europe does sell, they're much more common these days in the UK. But when you went abroad as a kid, paprika crisps were always very exciting because we didn't have them.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's such a lovely flavour.
It would be nice. I don't think I've ever had that.
A small, you've never had paprika crisps?
No.
It's actually, sometimes you find paprika flavoured Pringles. Other brands of crisp are available.
but
you get those sometimes. You definitely get them in continental Europe, but you occasionally get them in the UK. But paprika crisps are very, very delicious. Yeah, they're nice.
We need to do our transatlantic snack exchange again soon.
Yes, we do. I was thinking about that just the other week for some reason. I must have been eating something that I thought you would appreciate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sent Ryan some Jelly Babies once. Jelly so Babies, great. And did I send you some tablet?
You definitely did. There was one other thing too. It was some sort of tablet's the mint.
No, tablet's the mint. It's kind of like fudge, but it's got a different texture.
Yeah, there was a mint one, a mint bar that you were saying is like a hiking snack.
Oh yes, Kendall mint cake.
Yes, those are fantastic.
Kendall mint cake is lovely. It's because it's made out of minty sugar.
Yeah, for people who don't know, think the York. Peppermint patties, like the chocolate covered peppermint things, or the inside of Junior Mints, but just the inside of Junior Mints as an entire bar, and that's just what you eat. It was fantastic.
Apparently,
really gonna need to eat after we're done recording. I'm so hungry now.
Yeah, this has been a very, very foodie episode, hasn't it?
Oh man,
I'm pretty sure that Sir Edmund Hillary took Kendall mint cake with him on his descent of Everest. I think that's a thing that I've heard before. I'm also a scientist.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Words.
Yes. Words.
So, I came across this word in quite an interesting way. Purely because it sounds a little bit funny.
Okay.
And my husband said to me, that's a funny sounding word. What does it mean? How did it come to be that way? And I said, you know, that sounds like the sort of thing that someone who has a podcast about etymology might be interested in. I'm going to write that down. So perfect. I did. And the word in question is smug. S-M-U-G.
Smug. Yeah. Oh, and I
used it earlier. Yeah. And smug mode is in fact a quotation from Red Dwarf. I don't know if you know Red Dwarf. It's a 90s sci-fi comedy thing starring Craig Charles and Chris Barry. And my husband really loves Red Dwarf. And I really love my husband. So these days I do too. it's one of these things that, you know, when we first got together, he knew all about it and I didn't really. And we watched it together and we both very much enjoy the humour of Red Dwarf. And Crichton, who is the android on board the ship, the general arc of Crichton's character is that he starts off as a cleaning bot, and Lister, the kind of slightly anarchic, slacker, kind of useless guy who's also on the ship, he helps Crichton to break his programming so that he's able to experience more human emotions, I suppose.
Oh,
and
nice.
one of the things that Crichton learns is smug mode.
Awesome.
And so smug mode came up in our conversation somewhere or another, and Ross said to me, smug, that's a funny sounding word. And I said, yeah. And I couldn't really think of any other words that feel that way, you know, that with that same structure. So I got on the Google machine and I discovered some quite interesting things about the word smug. I discovered, first of all, that phrase, origin unknown. And we do enjoy when that happens, because generally it means there's a slightly more interesting story.
Yeah.
And Etym Online has to say that smug, the adjective, dates from the 1550s. And its original meaning at that time was trim, neat, spruce, or smart.
Oh.
And that surprised me, yeah, immediately, because I tend to think of it as a derogatory sort of term, you know, certainly a pejorative term to call someone smug.
Yeah.
But in fact, the word originally meant simply to be well-dressed, to look, you know, to look as though you'd taken some care over your attention. Care over your attention? Excuse me. Care over your appearance. I know what I'm talking about, honestly.
Yeah.
So, Etym Online reckons that this word comes from the Middle Low German schmucken, S-M-U-C-K-E-N.
Also a fantastically fun word to say.
Yeah, it's quite good fun. It has an umlaut as well for extra bonus
perfect.
Points, which probably means I'm pronouncing it incredibly badly, because as I discovered when I was in Berlin last year, I speak very, very bad German. I didn't know how bad my German was until I got to Germany, where I discovered that even the simplest words rendered the way that I believed they ought to be pronounced were unintelligible to speakers of German. So schmucken, perhaps schmucken, I don't know.
Yeah.
And the word schmucken means to adorn, like to dress.
Oh, okay.
And it then directed me towards smock. So.
Oh, okay. Right, yeah.
Smock got kind of interesting. Here's what Etym Online has to say about smock. Old English, smock, S-M-O-C, a garment worn by women corresponding to the shirt on men, from Proto-Germanic schmukas, the source also of Old Norse smocker, a smock, but this is perhaps from Old English. There are other potential sources, Old High German, North Frisian. And then we have this wonderful paragraph here. Klein's sources, Barnhart and the OED, see this as connected to a group of Germanic SM words having to do with creeping or pressing close, such as Old Norse smuga, to creep through an opening,
okay,
or to put on a garment. Smuga, a narrow cleft to creep through or a small hole. Old Swedish smog, a round hole for the head. Old English smugan or smugan, to creep, or smigel, a burrow. Compare also German schmiegen, to cling to, press close, or nestle, and schmuck, jewellery, adornments, from that same root schmucken, to adorn, to dress up. So this all made me think of Smeagol, quite simply. Right.
Yeah.
The words sounded the same. I started to think of the lovely little hobbit that eventually became that loathsome creature Gollum. Then we have Watkins, however, traces it to a possible Germanic base, Smook. Wetness, figuratively slipperiness, from the Pi root Mug, M-E-U-G, which means slimy or slippery, as in mucus.
Oh.
And then this lovely, lovely conclusion. Either way, the original notion then seems to have been, generally, garment one creeps or slips into by the same pattern
right.
that produced sleeve or slip. So, a smock is something that you slip or slide into. And
that's
when
really
one has slipped and slid into the thing that, you know, the thing that makes you feel good, then one is smug.
Okay.
Yeah. So we also have smug as a noun, and the OED has two noun senses, both of which are either obsolete or pretty obscure. Smug, first of all, again, we have of obscure origin, a blacksmith. So the 1600 citation that's given in the OED, a smug of Vulcan's forging trade.
Oh, that's awesome.
And there's a very, very lovely line from 1709 in Eward Writings 4133. "You're an impudent slut," cries the smug at his bellows.
Oh, that.
So, yeah,
wow.
a smug was a blacksmith. And we also have the second sense as a quiet or hardworking student. So from 1882, we have a smug was always unpopular, but all unpopular persons were not smugs. The quiet smug was generally not a rich man. So it kind of gave me the sense of, you know, I'm not here to study because my parents have lots of money. I'm here to study because I'm intelligent and I have to work hard and pay that off. So I won't be carousing and drinking with all you other young studenty types. I will be a smug at my books and, you know.
Right.
And then the word smug as a noun came to also be used to talk about a smug or a self-satisfied person, which seems like a pretty reasonable way to go. However, the really interesting thing about the word smug, which I'm currently failing to find in my research notes, is about the... Oh, where is it? Here it is, right here. Yes, comes from the OED. And the OED has this to say about the etymology of the word smug. This is the smug that we know that we kind of use today. Although the first definition given in the OED is of male persons, trim, neat, spruce or smart. And it says in later use, having a self-satisfied, conceited or consciously respectable air. So the first citation of the word smug in this sense, "they be so smug and smooth that they hear not so much as one hear of an honest man," from 1551. It's not until around about 1740 that sense of smug as in being self-satisfied seems to kind of come around, seems to come into the sense of it. And then we have B, the second sense, of women or girls. So another sort of, you know, she's indeed a good smug lass. We then have the second definition of the face, smooth or sleek. So a smug countenance. Not necessarily a self-satisfied, pleased with himself countenance. "It was edifying to behold him, fresh shaved and with smug face, singing out Amen," from Thackeray. And then again we have of things, smooth, clean, neat, trim or tidy. In later use, having an appearance suggestive of complacency or respectability. So we've definitely had this change. And it isn't until the fifth definition that we have this indicative of, characterised by complacency or conscious respectability. And we have in 1859 from Charles Kingsley, addressing the audience in a most smug and self-satisfied tone. or from Gerald, human arrogance in the smug belief of its own election looks upon its own looks upon its fellow as irrevocably lost. So, yeah, it's rather interesting to think that this word first meant you're looking good, and then, as language often does, as we certainly find, it got mean.
Yeah.
But the other very interesting thing that the OED has to say about the etymology of the word, firstly, it says of doubtful origin, which we're always interested in.
Yeah.
The form is against its being Low German smuck, which and schmuck, which is what Etym Online goes for. The form goes against this, as the change of K to G would be very irregular.
Hmm.
And indeed, I found that this was the case. So the opposite happens in both German and in a general etymological sense. You have words that terminate in G becoming words that are eventually terminate in K. But it seems that the notion of it going in the other direction is almost unheard of, except in the case of this word.
Hmm.
So
I guess that makes a certain amount of sense because of the whole thing, like, not that, like, language doesn't get simpler, as is often said, but the idea of it being physiologically convenient makes
absolutely.
A change. And so losing something, because when you go from the G to the K, you're losing the voicedness of that sound. So that feels like it should be a physically easier sound to make. And so maybe that's...
Yeah.
But that's why that makes sense to me. I don't have enough formal linguistics training, or indeed any.
Informal linguistics training. Yeah, well, I'm exactly the same. And because of that, my sort of next logical step, as far as I was concerned, was to say, well, what about other words that have that same ending? And so the first one that came to my mind was the word snug, S-N-U-G.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Okay. So snug, the first citation comes from 1590s. So not a million miles away from when smug is first written down. And Etym Online gives it as compact trim of a description of a ship, especially protected from the weather, which then, that leads us into the sense of being snug as a bug in a rug. So as ships could be protected from the rain and the elements, so could a person be. However, the etymology is very, very different for snug. Perhaps from a Scandinavian source such as Old Norse, snogger, S-N-O-G-G-R, which means short-haired, Old Swedish snygg, Old Danish snug, neat or tidy, perhaps from pie, kes, K-E-S, to scratch.
Oh.
All of which sounds incredibly random and disparate to me.
Yeah.
But then I'm not an etymologist. If I was, perhaps I would be able to say the word etymologist. But also that Proto-Indo-European root kes brought me to such an interesting word that I felt like it was a good place to stop. I don't know that I'm much the wiser about smug. I certainly can't be self-satisfied or complacent about my investigation into it. But I'm happy with the word, not even sure how to pronounce it, but so pleasing written down. Keister. That's spelled X-Y-S-T-E-R. And a keister, I think keister is probably the best way I would go for it, is a surgical instrument for scraping bones. From the 1680s, this is given. From the Greek keister, a graving tool from sighing to scrape. So from scraping to feeling cosy and safe from the weather, which sounds a little bit like, but is etymologically completely unrelated to being well-dressed, which then eventually was bastardised into being full of oneself and complacent, we have smug and then snug.
Wow.
And I'm still not really any the wiser as to why smug is that very unusual form, but I did very much enjoy finding out.
That's a good trip. Well, so when you were talking about smug being the noun forms of it, where it's a blacksmith and then much later on, it came to mean a person with the characteristics that we now apply to the adjective smug.
Yeah.
Was there a sense that the adjective took its meaning from the noun form of smug? Like,
to be smug was to act in a way that a smug would. Do you know what I mean? Like, did it was it a noun describing a self-satisfied person and then became an adjective for self-satisfaction? Or is there any indication of which one of those came first, or did they...
Hold on. So Etym Online states the meaning of having a self-satisfied air is from 1701. However, a smug or self-satisfied person, the first written citation is given as 1891. So it would seem to be the case that the adjective gave birth to the noun.
Yeah, so a smug is such because they are a person who is so smug that they just it just takes over their personality.
Oh, I have to give you this citation also. The OED is just such a beautiful place to take a swim.
It is.
The ocean of silly cant which has been poured forth on the occasion by smugs and prigs.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, lovely. So,
and smock is, it's a, the smock connection is, there's a lot, yeah, there's so many of these little branches that kind of, just wandering trails into the woods that you kind of go, oh, I want to follow that, but there's a million of them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really interesting.
I really loved the sense of smock being sort of slidey and almost slimy, slipping into something.
When I think of a smock, I think of, I mean, I may just be because I'm ignorant and that's why I'm thinking this way, but what I think of when I think of a smock is I think of sort of a, well, like a rain slicker, like a poncho that you put on over top. Particularly, I think of painters for some reason, but I think the connection.
Painters do wear smocks, yeah, yeah.
So I make that connection
very
of like
loose,
getting
sort of formless garment, nothing,
keeping stuff
nothing very
off of you that would otherwise be sticky and slimy and kind of gross, and protecting you from that. But also the fact that there was one of the things you were talking about was so there was a little hole, like involving passage through a little hole. And when I think of what a smock would look like laid out, it would just be a piece of fabric with a hole for your head.
Yeah, yeah. Like a sort of a poncho type setup. I don't think that there's any particular... I mean, I personally don't have any particular connection between a smock being something to keep other things off you. A smock is just, you know, it's simply a type of garment. The other thing that I found quite interesting, so Etym Online talked about the different etymologists and their different theories about the origin of the word smock. So we had Klein and Barnhart and the OED on one, you know, sort of holding up one argument. And then we had Watkins. So because of the kind of brain that I have, I wondered about Klein and Barnhart and Watkins. And Watkins in particular interested me purely because Calvert Watkins, a very unusual first name, Calvert Watkins wrote a book about comparative Indo-European poetics, and it's called How to Kill a Dragon, which I thought was quite lovely. How to Kill a Dragon, Aspects of Indo-European Poetics.
It's fantastic.
But, so I think that you're right. There's so many ends to pull on there. There's so many paths to follow and potential ways to go. And to be honest with you, sometimes it's so much more satisfying not to unravel the whole garment.
Yeah.
Not to find the answer, you know, to wonder and to folk etymologize and to just to sort of see how that goes. Explore rather than solve.
Mm-hmm.
I also have to point out that I do feel a bit sorry for dragons. All they ever, you know, they're always killed. Did anyone ever try not killing a dragon?
I feel like the people who were killed by the dragons probably gave that a shot, even if just sort of accidentally.
I feel like dragons have got a bad rap. They just needed a better agent. If their PR had been handled in a slightly different way, I think dragons would have been, you know...
I do
remember reading a story as a kid about, you know, sort of from the dragon's point of view, all these twerps turning up with armour trying to kill me. Don't they know I can breathe fire? That sort of thing. Which was quite pleasing. But yeah, maybe the dragons were just pissed off with everybody trying to kill them all the time.
I like it. And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture.
To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.